going to Matthew chapter 17. As we are continuing our series here through the Gospel of Matthew, this is message number 41, entitled Kingdom Glory. We'll be looking at Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 to 13. And as we get started here, I'll read verses 1 to 3. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into an high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them. And his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah, talking with him. So chapter 16 had Israel's rejection of Jesus as Messiah, as Son of God, in sort of the background. And there's a discernible shift as you read through chapter 16 in Jesus' ministry. He turns from the offer of the kingdom to Israel to focus on his approaching crucifixion. And after the confrontation that Jesus had with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, he was speaking with his 12 disciples privately, and he was speaking with them primarily about his identity. And the people of Israel, they generally thought well of Jesus. They thought that he was a great prophet. They certainly recognized that he had great power. They had benefited from him being among them. But this fell short of actual belief in him and knowledge of him as the Son of God. Really, when you think about it, it's not all that different today with many that take that sort of approach. Oh, Jesus was a good teacher. He was a good moralist. He was a humanitarian. And all of those sort of ideas are out there, and people sort of generally think well of Jesus but fall short of actually believing in him. And that was the case with most of Israel in that day. Well, Peter confessed that, Jesus, you're the Messiah. You're the Christ. You're the anointed of God. You're the Son of the living God. And so Jesus proceeded to give them new revelation that he would build a church for the intervening age. And in preparation for them to hear about his coming death, he declared that the gates of hell wouldn't stop him. Now, the message that Jesus gave through most of chapter 16, was that suffering and death come before glory and the kingdom. And that was really just a hard message for the disciples to understand. So having come to the point where they have embraced, they've believed, they've embraced Jesus is the Messiah, he's the Son of God, this is happening. There seem to have been thoughts on the disciples' mind of that coming kingdom and the glory that would ensue. So it was hard for them to understand, but Jesus has taught that he's going to come again in great power and glory to bring judgment, and anyone who would follow Jesus has to take up their cross in this life and follow after him, obeying what he said, and even to the death. Well, the end of chapter 16 is actually connected to chapter 17. It's really just continuing on. And he prophesied there in the end of chapter 16 that some of those 12 men would not see death before they saw Jesus in his kingdom glory. And this prophecy, when you think about it, includes two categories. So you had the 12 apostles that are standing before Jesus, and he tells these 12, some of you will not see death before seeing his kingdom glory. So the two categories would be, first of all, some. Now this turns out to be three, as we find out in the passage in chapter 17, but nevertheless, some of them, they would see this kingdom glory, and they would see it before they died. But then there's another category, isn't there? There's also the rest. Whoever the sum takes out a certain number out of the 12, and whoever is left over, well, the rest essentially are being told they will not see it no matter how long they live on this earth. They're not going to see it. Oh, they'll learn about it. They'll hear about it later. But they're not going to actually see it, not in their mortal bodies. So chapter 17 opens up now with this account of the transfiguration of Jesus Christ. He is still with his 12 disciples, and then he chooses three to go up onto a high mountain apart from the others. And this incident on the mountain is confirming for the disciples, but what exactly was being confirmed? And that's really what we want to consider in this passage tonight. So we have two parts. Verses 1 to 8, they go up the mountain where they see the white light on the mountain of Jesus' transfiguration. And in verses 9 to 13, where they're coming down the mountain and they have this exchange with Jesus concerning Elijah. So we'll start with the first part as they go up onto the mountain in verses 1 to 8. Let's read verse number 1. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into an high mountain apart. Now, we do have to remember that chapter divisions and verse numbers, these were not inspired in the original writings of the Scripture. They are a much, much later addition to the Bible. And they were added essentially as being a help in reference and in study. And for the most part, they're actually very useful for that. I think there are some things that come along with them are somewhat negative that we have to keep in mind. But sometimes as we're reading through the Bible, we run into places sort of like here where that chapter division is placed in such a way that it makes a really hard break. It seems like such a hard break between chapter 16 and 17, and it's actually not a hard break. It's actually a continuation. It might have even been better had verse 28 been the first verse of chapter 17 a little bit. But nevertheless, we just have to keep those sort of things in mind as we're reading through the Bible, and we have to sort of learn to ignore those verse numbers and chapter numbers and then also be able to use them and to use them in a helpful way. Well, this first incident is connected with the preceding passage and particularly that last verse of chapter 16. And so you see that the passages are connected. So as soon as you start reading "and after 6 days," you've got a conjunction and you've also got a time marker that is relative to what has just happened. So there's no question that these are connected in Matthew's account. So this 6 days indicates that this was a short time after the happenings in Caesarea Philippi. Mark also emphasizes that it was 6 days. I think Luke writes a little less specifically, saying that it was about 8 days. So obviously, they all put these events right together, separated by about a week in which they occurred. And so they clearly are connected and should be kept together. Now, because of the proximity, they had been in Caesarea Philippi. They've gone to the sort of the extreme northern part. In fact, as you get to the extents of that region, then you have, you know, Syria, I believe it is to the north, and the Israel territory there to the south. But because of that proximity, it makes it very likely that Mount Hermon is this high mountain that is referred to. None of the gospel writers name the mountain. They don't give enough specifics to identify it. But again, being in Caesarea Philippi, being in that area, being in the northern part of Israel, very likely it was Mount Hermon. But we don't know that for sure, and so we certainly wouldn't want to take that too far. But it would also make sense then, if this is Mount Hermon, it would also make sense as to why Jesus took his disciples to Caesarea Philippi in the first place. Now, again, it sort of continues thematically with what we've seen, and we're going to continue to see as really Jesus seems to sort of being pulling away from Israel and pulling away from the multitudes and pulling away from the crowds. And he goes up into this extreme northern region, a lot of Gentile presence in the area. But if Mount Hermon was actually his target destination for this transfiguration, then it certainly would make sense why he had gone to Caesarea Philippi in the first place. So after Jesus told them that some of them standing there would see his kingdom glory, he took Peter and he took James and John apart from the other 9 disciples, and he went up into the mountain. Now again, James and John would be the brothers, the sons of Zebedee that are referred to here. Verse number 2, and was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. Now, the word for transfigured that is translated from, it is where we get our word metamorphosis from. And the word means to transform. It means to change into another form. So these three apostles saw Jesus transformed. So this isn't just some sort of symbolic sight or anything like that. They see Jesus transformed before their eyes. And Matthew described the face of Jesus as being bright like the sun, his clothes as being a dazzling white like light. So obviously, Jesus is radiating a supernatural light from himself, which is a way that is typically described in the appearance of angels, but it certainly is also the brightness of the coming of the Lord is something that is associated with his return. We see that in some of the prophecies in Scripture, that there's a brightness about it, a light about it. And so we don't know exactly. Peter just sort of compares it, Matthew compares it to the sun, the brightness of the sun, and he compares it to just the whiteness of just a pure light. And Jesus said, remember that he had just told them that they would see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And so they were obviously seeing him in the glory of that coming. Verse number 3. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with him. So as the three disciples see Jesus transformed, this supernatural light that is radiating from him, then they also saw Moses and Elijah appear. And not only did they appear, but they talked with Jesus. Now, Matthew doesn't tell us what they were talking about, but when you read Luke's account, Luke does add that they were talking to Jesus about his approaching death. That was what they were talking about. And again, Matthew just doesn't draw any attention to that in this account. But of course, then the question has to come, well, why Moses and Elijah? And this is a passage that has led to all sorts of wild theories about why Moses and Elijah appeared and what this means and what the significance of it is. But if we just read this whole event in context and some of the discussion as they're going down the mountain, then we realize that in context, we're actually given a connection to each of them. We're given a connection to Moses. We're given a connection to Elijah in the things that take place here. So one of the things that happen is you have this voice from heaven in this cloud that is also a bright cloud. It's thoroughly engulfed in light or it's radiating light, and there's a voice that speaks. And when the voice speaks, there's an echoing of Moses' prophecy about God sending to Israel another prophet that would command them. In other words, a greater prophet that would command them. And also we have the three asking Jesus questions about Elijah and Jesus explaining about Elijah and so on. So when we think about it, we could probably come up with reasons for any number of different Old Testament saints to have appeared in this particular setting, but we do have connections both with Moses and Elijah in what takes place, and we also, when we think about those connections, we realize that there are also specific connections with Moses and Elijah and Jesus' coming kingdom. And so, it makes sense that they were the ones that appeared to Jesus and were speaking to him concerning his death. Verse number 4. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here three tabernacles, one for thee and one for Moses and one for Elijah. So Peter again speaks up, and we've talked about how as we progress in Matthew's gospel, sort of Peter sort of comes to the forefront of the disciples, of the apostles, and seems to have a bold role, speaks up a lot of the times. And here again, he speaks up, and he wants to build three tabernacles, one for Jesus, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Now, this might seem like just sort of something very random. Like, where did this come from? You know, Peter, why are you saying this? But actually, Peter's suggestion here shows what it was that Peter thought about what was happening. What it was that Peter thought that he was seeing. Now, Jesus had said that they would see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And so Peter thought he was seeing the kingdom coming. He thought he was witnessing the kingdom arriving. Now, Moses had prophesied, again, that a greater prophet than him would come. That's Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse number 15. And Malachi had prophesied that Elijah would come before the day of the Lord. Malachi chapter 4, verses 4 to 6. And so here they were. Here's Moses and here's Elijah with Jesus. And Jesus is in glory and he is in power. And so the setting up of his kingdom seems like it's just about to happen. This is finally happening. Now, you will recall that Zechariah prophesied about the coming of the Messiah. And in chapter 14, he prophesied that when the Messiah reigns as king over all of the earth, that's in chapter 14 and verse number 9, that the nations will all come to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. That's chapter 14 and verse number 16. And see, this word tabernacle sort of throws us off. I've seen some crazy suggestions about what people think Peter was suggesting. Tabernacles refers to booths. If you recall the Feast of Tabernacles, that they were to erect these little booths, these little ramshackle tent sort of affairs that they were to dwell in, because they were remembering the people of Israel dwelling in the wilderness. And the Feast of Tabernacles had great eschatological significance, because it's the fulfilling essentially of the deliverance of Israel, and it's a feast of joy. It's supposed to be a feast of great celebration. And so this is why Peter wanted to build tabernacles or booths for Jesus, for Moses, and Elijah, because he thought the kingdom feast that has been prophesied, like in Zechariah, like in Isaiah chapter 25, he thought this kingdom feast was about to happen, because the kingdom was arriving. I mean, here's Moses, here's Elijah, here's Jesus in glory and in power on the earth. And so he wants to build these tabernacles. So this is why Peter says, well, it's good that we're here. It's good that we're here. In other words, he's acknowledging this is a great blessing. We're here at the very beginning of the kingdom. Probably hardly anything any more exciting could be imagined by them in their minds. Only Peter wasn't completely right. He wasn't way far off. He was just mainly wrong about the timing of events. Verse number 5. While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." So while Peter was saying these things, this cloud overshadows them. It comes over them, sort of covers them, as it were. And Matthew describes it as a bright cloud. So there's light around it. There's light from it and light in it. It seems to be a cloud of light. And it doesn't maybe make a lot of sense for us to comprehend, but that's essentially what it's described as being like. And of course, this whole scene echoes what Matthew reported much earlier, chapter 3, verse 17, and Jesus after his baptism by John and the voice from heaven and so on. So this voice, which is God the Father speaking, identifies Jesus as the Messiah, as God's Son, but also gives the command, hear him. And again, this goes along with Moses' prophecy about God would send another prophet to them, a greater prophet than Moses, and to him they were to listen. In other words, God's going to, Moses says, I have received the law and I've given the law to you. God's going to send another lawgiver. He's going to send a new lawgiver, and him you must hear or obey. And so essentially we have this echoed here in this identification of Jesus. And specifically, I believe the emphasis as we look at the context of all of this is that they need to listen to what Jesus is saying, particularly about his death and about his kingdom. And again, they clearly don't have everything all sorted out in their minds as to how these things are fit together and how these things are playing out. Verse 6, and when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. And so the only response that they have to give at this time was just to fall on their faces in fear. And again, I haven't even really pointed out some of the other echoes from Sinai that we can find in this account, but this would be another one of those. They hear the voice of God and they're just stricken with fear. They fall down. They're covering their face. They're not looking so that they can't see anything, and they are afraid. But verse 7 says, and Jesus came and touched them and said, arise and be not afraid. So Jesus touches them. In other words, confirming his reality. This isn't a dream. You're not in a trance. It's not some sort of vision. Everything that they saw was real. It was right there in front of them. And Jesus touches them. He's confirming the reality of everything that they have seen and then commands them to rise up and to not be afraid. Verse 8, and when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. So when they did look up, the scene was over. What they had seen was real, but it was over. There was no one there besides Jesus. And Jesus himself had returned to his previous appearance. This previous appearance with Paul describes in Philippians chapter 2, and we sometimes refer to it as Jesus setting aside his glory. And if you think about like Jesus' prayer in John chapter 17, when he was talking, praying to the Father, and he was talking about having the glory restored that he had before the world was with the Father. And again, these things are hard for us to comprehend, and I don't really know that we can fully comprehend them. But he had set aside that glory, but for this brief moment, he took up this glory again. And these three men on this mountain saw it. But now Jesus has returned. He has returned to his vision of humiliation, the suffering servant that Isaiah prophesied. So what does that tell us? Well, what that tells us and what it told them was that this was not the arrival of the kingdom. This was not the exaltation of Jesus Christ in his glory to reign over the kingdom. This was just a brief preview of that kingdom glory and of Jesus as King. Well, then we get to the second part of this account, and that begins in verse number 9, where they have this conversation about Elijah. Verse 9. And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, tell the vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead. So after this has happened, and they have somewhat recovered, they are on the way down the mountain. So they have not yet rejoined the other apostles, still just Jesus and the three. And they're on their way to rejoin them. But Jesus charges them that they're not to tell anyone about it. Now, the command to keep quiet has And it's been troubling for a lot of people as you go through the Gospels and Jesus gives this command not to tell anyone about this or that. But here you can see, again, you're reading this context, you're coming out of chapter 16 and you're reading this context. You can see that Jesus clarifies this command to keep quiet by a certain time limit. He says, don't tell anyone until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead. So after that he is resurrected, just as he has prophesied and foretold to them that he will be after he is killed, until after his resurrection, don't tell anyone what you have seen. Now, what did this mean? Well, it simply meant that they weren't to tell anyone this revelation yet because it was not yet time for that. There will be a time after his resurrection when they are to speak forth these revelations that Jesus has given them. But we're still at the point where, for the most part, only 12 men on the planet know these new revelations that Jesus has been giving. And now only 3 of them have actually seen Jesus in his kingdom glory. And the time for them to speak these revelations to others just it hasn't come yet. And so they are to keep quiet about it. And notice also that here Jesus is again reemphasizing, he's reinforcing to them about his death and his resurrection. And that was something that had been so troubling to them a week earlier when Jesus spoke so openly and so clearly that he's going to go to Jerusalem and he's going to be killed. In other words, he's going to be put to death. He's going to be executed. And you know, almost you could maybe see them in their minds thinking, well, just don't go to Jerusalem then. You know, that seems an easy enough problem to avoid. It was so troubling to them. But here Jesus is again reaffirming that this is what is going to happen. And he's going to continue to talk about this as you proceed through Matthew's gospel until he gets to Jerusalem. Now, verse number 10. And his disciples asked him, saying, why then say the scribes that Elijah must first come? This is another one of those responses that, again, just seems sort of random. Why did, you know, that's an odd response. Jesus just said, you know, he's going to die again, and he's talking about the resurrection, and he's telling you not to tell anyone about this until after that time, giving assurance that it's going to happen. And they just all of a sudden ask this question about Elijah. Well, actually, it shows us that the disciples are certainly starting to put some of these things together. They have a lot of pieces that they're having a hard time sort of fitting together, but they are starting to put some of these things together. So think about this. Jesus had just reaffirmed to them about his death, and they respond by asking about the coming of Elijah. Well, naturally, they've asked that question because they literally just saw Elijah come. They literally saw Elijah come to the earth. And so if Elijah is going to come before the coming of the kingdom, then why is Jesus still talking about dying? Why is he talking about death and resurrection? So Elijah, they had seen Elijah come, but Jesus is essentially telling them this isn't the start of the kingdom. The kingdom has not yet arrived. So they're asking, well, why did the scribes teach that Elijah had to first come? Meaning that before the Messiah would come, before the establishing of his kingdom, that Elijah must first come. Why did they teach that? Because they had just seen Elijah and the kingdom was not coming, was essentially the message that they had understood from what Jesus was telling them. Verse number 11, and Jesus answered and said unto them, Elijah truly shall first come and restore all things. So first of all, Jesus confirms that that actually is true. Elijah is prophesied to come first before the Messiah comes, before he establishes the kingdom in Israel. And not only does Elijah come first, but notice what Jesus said. He comes and he restores all things. Now, what is this restoring that Jesus is talking about? Well, and again, if you go back to Malachi chapter 4, in particular verses 5 and 6, Elijah comes to restore Israel. The result of Elijah's coming is the turning of the hearts of the fathers to their children. It's the restoration of Israel. He's coming to prepare them for their Messiah. The coming of Elijah results in the conversion and the restoration of Israel with the coming of the Messiah and the establishment of the kingdom following. And Jesus is confirming once again to his disciples that that is absolutely correct. And even as the scribes have understood that and have taught that, they have been absolutely right about that. Verse 12, "But I say unto you that Elijah is come already, and they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them." So here again, we see Jesus giving revelation to his disciples, and in this case, particularly the three apostles. Elijah had come, he said, but they didn't recognize him, and they rejected him. So Elijah had come, but he wasn't received. And so Israel wasn't restored. And in fact, Israel is on their way to a great judgment and destruction and scattering that's going to come to them really in not too long a time, about 40 years from this time. Elijah had come, Jesus says, but he wasn't received. And Jesus further stated that they would do likewise to the Son of Man. And then again, he's talking about being rejected by Israel and being put to death by the leaders of Israel. And verse 13 concludes this incident saying, "Then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist." So they understood that talking about Elijah, Jesus meant John the Baptist. He had told them earlier that Elijah had come if they would receive it. That's back in chapter 11 and verse number 14. But of course, they didn't receive it. And that led to the revelation of the mystery of the kingdom, that the kingdom is delayed. John had fulfilled part of the forerunner prophecy, but not all of it. The day of the Lord did not come, and Israel was not restored. So there are still prophecies to be fulfilled, which Jesus revealed will be fulfilled with his second coming, the mystery of the kingdom that was kept hidden, that he revealed to those 12 apostles. And so again, they're starting to put together and to see how some of these pieces are fitting together. Now, when we look at this passage, there really are two main difficulties here. And the first is understanding what's here, and then the second is understanding why it's here. And I guess you could say that about just about any passage. But that really are the two difficulties in this passage. Now, clearly, Peter later referred to this event and its fulfillment of this prophecy that some of them standing there would see. So 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 16 to 18. "For we have not followed cunningly devised fables when we made known unto you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For he received from God the Father honor and glory when there came such a voice to him from the excellent glory, 'This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased.' And this voice which came from heaven we heard when we were with him in the Holy Mount." Now, not all of the apostles could say that, but Peter could, and so could James, though James was long dead by the time Peter wrote that, and so could John, his brother. And in fact, John does refer to this somewhat in John chapter 1 and verse 14. "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." So clearly they refer to this event in retrospect and I don't mean vision in the sense of a you know, like a dream or sort of vision, but I mean a vision in the sense that they saw it. Peter and John would even talk about later being eyewitnesses and ear witnesses, as it were. They saw and they heard these very things, and they really happened in front of them. They saw this, and so they told others about it. Moses and Elijah appeared, and they had certain significance for the coming of the kingdom. And in fact, the kingdom is crucial to this whole scene of transfiguration. So this is what has happened. Why did this happen? Why did they see this a view of Jesus and see Moses and Elijah? And why did this happen? Well, this event certainly confirmed Jesus and his identity as the Messiah of prophecy. And it also gave these three, Peter, James, and John, a preview of his kingdom glory. Though it wasn't time for that yet, because the mystery of the kingdom being revealed to them, they were to understand that this is not Jesus coming, and in fact, he would talk later about his death and resurrection in terms of his departing. So that's the mystery of the kingdom, is that he's going to depart, but he's going to return. And when he returns, he's going to come in power and glory like they saw. It also confirmed the kingdom as a real, physical, future kingdom. So think about this scene for a moment and the significance of it for these apostles. So here we are on this mountain, on the earth, in the promised land, and you have Old Testament saints that are present, and you have a glorified Jesus that is present, and you also have believing Jews who are in their mortal bodies, and they are all together in this one place on the earth, just as it will be when the kingdom comes. Now, Peter's reactions showed that he interpreted what he saw as indication of fulfilled prophecy and the arrival of the kingdom. Peter just wasn't right about that, the arrival of the kingdom, because it wasn't time for that yet. So obviously he hadn't fully comprehended the mystery of the kingdom that Jesus had revealed to the 12, but it did give him confirmation that these prophecies would be fulfilled. And why would such confirmation be necessary? Well, again, think about context, and we're at this turning point in Matthew's gospel, and from here Jesus is only going to talk more about his death. What is it that he's communicating to them as he's confirming them? As he's confirming this, his death is not a hindrance or an obstacle to the restoration of Israel and to the coming of the kingdom. In fact, it's necessary for it. It's not going to come apart from it. So they are not to see Jesus' death as being a stop to what was supposed to happen, but rather it's necessary for it to happen at all. So they are to understand what the mystery of the kingdom is, and they are to preach and teach that message, though again, it's not time for that just yet.